Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 meter peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, Hungary and China promise a strong and effective trade relationship. But how will that work if the rest of the EU is contemplating punitive sanctions? Also, the advert for Apple's new iPad that's badly backfired. A battle for the takeover of the company that owns the rights to many of the world's most popular songs. And how to write a Eurovision Song Contest winner. We've got an expert opinion. That's all coming up. But let's start with Apple, one of the world's biggest corporations, which has also been, up to now, a very clever communicator. Style, design and cool have been its signature. But the advert for its latest iPad has landed with a bit of a thud.
The most powerful iPad ever is also the thinnest.
All I ever need is you.
What you actually see is a huge hydraulic press crushing into oblivion objects including musical instruments and books. The idea is to show how their creativity has been compressed into the new machine. But celebrities including Hugh Grant and Justine Bateman have reacted with horror to the destruction on view. Apple boss Tim Cook's been called tone-deaf. He posted on Twitter about the device where he asked people to imagine all the things it'll be used to create. The BBC's approached Apple for comment, but hasn't as yet had a response. So how big a misstep is this for Apple? I've been speaking to Mark Gorkowski, PR and crisis consultant. First, what did he think of the advert?
Well, everybody is curious about Apple's advertising. Whenever a new product is dawning, it comes complete framed by a great piece of advertising. And historically, Apple have created some of the world's greatest advertising. You know, it's Apple Mac original ad back in the day is heralded as one of the greatest of all times. So when I saw this commercial sort of take shape, my jaw dropped. I found it astonishing that a brand that was absolutely so close to the cultural zeitgeist now moved into a place which showed just how hubristic and how unattached they were to the very creative community that they have been fueling for decades.
So clearly a misstep. It's not something they calculated and wanted to get some controversy. You reckon this is just a mistake?
I think it's a very poor commercial. I think that they haven't taken account for the paranoia that exists through the creative community, particularly about AI at the moment. And the idea of crushing all this creativity into a nice little flat iPad was probably thought to be a great little commercial. Unfortunately, they haven't put it into context.
In a way, they want to sell these things, but they must want to sell them not just to their current community, but more widely. So in that sense, perhaps it does work, because an awful lot more people are watching this and thinking about it than would otherwise have done.
I think people are now considering the Apple brand. It is dealing with a number of court cases around the world at the moment, related to perhaps some of their actions in how they've grown. We look at the big titans of the internet and Silicon Valley at the moment, and we feel uncomfortable about the power that they exert. And for a new iPad that is described as thinner than any other and lighter than any other, one then sort of skews down to that and said, is that all it can do? But I don't think they want to create such controversy within the community that drives their cult-like status.
Is this going to hurt them, though? I mean, is it going to hurt the bottom line, or is it just a storm in a teacup, do you think?
Well, these things tend to be a storm in a teacup, particularly when you've got sort of social media pile-ons. If a brand doesn't learn from its mistakes and carries on regardless, if they don't look at this and think, hang on a minute, you know, let's look at the criticism, let's analyse the criticism, perhaps that's the mistake they'll make. They're a big brand, but they've got a number of challenges that they face at the moment, particularly around copyright, both in a number of products at the moment. And, you know, these things are a bit like water on stone, and they will erode trust, and people will begin to think twice about it. I suspect that Apple will bounce back. This will be perceived to be a misstep, and I'm sure they'll move forward. But on the other hand, they're in the dangerous space at the moment of actually, you know, being that, as I said, that all powerful hubristic brand that might not take the sort of criticism and carry on, and that's where the erosion of the brand's values starts to happen.
Mark Borkowski there on Apple's latest iPad advert. Now, there's been something of a takeover struggle going on over a company called Hipgnosis. You may have heard of Hipgnosis when it bought up the rights to some of the world's most popular music. Well, what you may have heard there, I guess, Kaiser Chiefs, Shakira, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers, they're all among their properties. But Hipgnosis, the company, has been plagued in recent years by a falling off of confidence. Investors wondering if the portfolio actually had the value it had promised. A takeover battle resulted, with US private equity group Blackstone now offering $1.6 billion and its rival Concord now deciding it's not going to match that. Well, I asked Jem Aswad, executive music editor at Variety, to give us the history of Hipgnosis.
In 2018, when Merck, Mercury Addison, and Nile Rodgers launched Hipgnosis, you know, Merck is a great salesman. And he said countless times that songs are an asset class like oil or gold. They have a very, very, very long life. They're undervalued, et cetera, et cetera. That drove the value of song catalogs up enormously. Now, that market started tailing off about 2 years ago. I mean, one thing that actually oddly benefited it was, awful as this sounds, the pandemic, because they showed that things like, you know, touring did not do well during the pandemic, obviously. But because people were streaming so much, the value of songs went up even more. Catalogs were going for $400 million. You know, we heard about a $600 million deal. None of this stuff is confirmed, of course, but that's what we hear. But the trouble is, once you acquire those songs, what do you do with them? Songs are very hard to monetize. It's a lot of work. You have to get them in commercials. You have to get them in movies. You have to get musicals made. You know, there's all kinds of things like that that you can exploit a catalog with. Now, a company like Universal Music Publishing, Sony Music Publishing, Primary Wave Music, they are built to do that. They have whole departments that are just basically flogging the songs day in, day out, you know, generating money for the catalogs, for the writers, for their estates, et cetera, et cetera. Hipgnosis is not really set up to do that. And a couple of years ago, I wrote an article that just said, now that you've acquired that multi-million dollar song catalog, what are you going to do with it? And the fact that they paid top dollar for these catalogs that they haven't really been able to exploit to their full extent is the real problem. And people were saying all along it was a house of cards, and they had a very good run, but it looks like that run is pretty near its end.
Well, and also, of course, I mean, we talk about it as an asset class in a way, but of course, it's not like, you know, tin or copper or gold or something. This is something that depends on what you like. I mean, and that certain people, individuals, certain bands, Pink Floyd, Kanye West, I suppose I'm thinking of, potentially, reputationally, could suffer. And then the asset goes down.
Oh, 100%. And some companies, like, for example, Primary Wave does no deals for catalogs that are less than 20 years old. Nostalgia usually works in 20-year cycles. You can tell what songs are pretty much going to live for another couple of decades after 20 years. So they'll buy things that are arguably not that cool, like a Journey catalog or something like that. And Hipgnosis bought a lot of brand new ones that are, in that sense, unproven. And yes, It is a perishable asset. Even the ones that have passed that 20-year test of time, how much more time do they really have? You know, they do age out. It's like you've got Gershwin and Hoagie Carmichael and people like that who decades and decades later are still popular, but most of them aren't. Once most of the audience that is going to remember these songs isn't really involved in pop culture anymore, the value starts to go down. And as you just said, look at a Roger Waters or a Kanye West. They have drastically lowered the value of their music, you know, with their statements.
Well, yeah, Jim, I mean, are we saying then really that whoever gets Hypnosis, whether it's Blackstone or Concord or someone else, in the end, what they're doing is managing decline? This is not an area that's really going to be a long-term banker for anyone.
Oh, yes, it will. It will. When you look at something like the Queen catalog, for example, which is still on the market, those songs are going to be valuable for decades to come. Even though We're the Champions and We Will Rock You, those two songs are closing in on 50 years old. They've got probably another 50 years of life in them. Maybe not that much, you know, maybe 30 or 40, but that's a lot. And that's still a way that you can generate an awful lot of money from them. Those are the gold standard. The Queen catalog, the Beatles catalog, the Stones catalog, not that the latter two are for sale probably ever. Those will live on for up to 100 years, I would almost dare say. Music is still a great, great asset. Genesis sold their catalog for $300 million last year, you know, so somebody clearly believes in it.
Jem Aswad there of Variety. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service.
The plane started to shake a little bit, something that alerted us that there was something not right.
Remarkable personal stories told by the people that lived them.
Deep down inside you, you do have courage. You mightn't feel you've got courage. You mightn't feel that you're brave or resilient, but it's there waiting, just waiting to help you get through bad times.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now let's catch up on some of what's been happening with Kerry Leahy, adjunct professor of economics at Columbia University, and taking a look at the markets. I guess the most impressive thing really was the way in which Airbnb fell, Kerry. What was going on there?
Well, this is one of those situations where a company reports great earnings, but investors don't care because they were rather lukewarm, if not disappointing, about explaining the future. So it's a day where, well, you had a great quarter, but that's old news, and people wanted to see a better outlook than they portrayed their business being. So that was the downer, and that's why the price of the stock was down sharply.
Yeah, 7%, quite something. But let's talk about the wider markets on all this, because maybe the most significant mega market, Chase, is the labor market at the moment, because we've been talking, you and I, for quite a while about how, you know, the number of jobs, the number of jobless people out there affects the wider economy. And we had some interesting figures today suggesting that actually the number of jobless going up, and that therefore perhaps that might actually lead to a better outcome for those who want to see interest rates go down. So just explain what's been happening.
Well, absolutely. What happens is once a week we get a measure of individuals in the U.S. who apply for unemployment insurance benefits. And the big thing about this number is that it's very timely. It's only, let's say, 10 to 14 days old. So it's the most up-to-date indicator, but it's only talking about, at best, half the marketplace. It's talking about layoffs. It's not talking about if firms want to hire new workers at the same time they're laying off other workers. And for the first time in 8 months, the number moved up sharply. It's still low by any historical imagination, and people continue to look for another possibility for the Fed to sort of inch or dip their toe into the easing waters by the end of the year. And clearly, if you kept seeing these kinds of rises in the claims figures and the implication of a softer labor market, it would give the Fed some breathing room and allow them to at least tempt the market with the possibility of lower rates at the end of the year.
Yeah, and very briefly, we've got, of course, the inflation, latest inflation readings next week. Any expectations there?
Well, the market has been burned because while the numbers weren't terrible, they were disappointing relative to expectations. And I would think there the market's is looking desperately for a number that's probably below 3% annualized, but they may not get that.
Well, we'll talk about it with you next week, I'm sure, when it comes out. Thanks very much indeed, Kerry Leahy there. Now, the official phrases coming out of the visit of China's president to Hungary have been conspicuously positive, even lyrical. The two countries are embarking on a golden voyage of bilateral relations. They would be involved in key projects like a railway between Hungary and Serbia. They'd expand cooperation in the nuclear industry. Ties would be elevated to what's called an all-weather comprehensive strategic partnership. And they deepen economic trade, investment and financial cooperation. Now, that last one is interesting. The European Union, of which Hungary is, of course, a member, has been giving a rather less friendly view of trade with Beijing. Fears over China's overproduction being exported to Europe at low prices and killing off European manufacturing, for example, in electric cars, have led to threats of high tariffs. So can Hungary step outside all that? Well, in his speech, President Xi Jinping was careful to emphasise the importance of a relationship with the whole EU.
China values its comprehensive strategic partnership with the European Union and views Europe as an important pole in a multipolar world and also a key partner in China's bid to advance Chinese modernization. China supports Hungary in playing a bigger role in the EU and promoting greater progress in China-EU relations.
And that was Xi Jinping. Well, the BBC's Nick Thorpe says the government in Budapest is keen to develop its links with Beijing.
What Hungary says is, look, we are open to China, while other EU countries are saying they're wary of China, they're listening to US messages to be wary of what they call the Chinese agenda in Europe. It's the opposite here in Hungary. Mr. Orban has said he has a pragmatic foreign policy, an opening to the East, often an opening to Russia. That includes Russia, of course, and President Putin, with whom Mr. Orban shook hands when he was last in Beijing last October. But also, I think we've heard less until today about Hungary's close relationship with China, its skill in attracting all this Chinese investment. It's not worried at all about Chinese influence and so on. And so very warm welcome, sort of round off this Chinese president's visit. There is some criticism, though, as well as that from, for example, opposition parties here. They tried to display a European Union flag on one of the bridges yesterday. They were immediately surrounded by Chinese agents, Chinese activists, to prevent a Chinese flag being shown. There's also been attempts to show Tibetan flags, which also failed because of Hungarian or Chinese police moving very quickly. There's one other issue here which has been warned about by opposition here in Hungary, is that Chinese police have been invited to come to Hungary in the future. We don't know when or many details of that. And again, some people are worried that that's an infringement or could be an infringement in the future of Hungarian sovereignty.
Nick Thorpe there. Let's turn our thoughts then to South Korea. Now, the president there, Yoon Suk-yeol, says he wants to create a new ministry to address the country's disastrously low birth rate. He said the new ministry would coordinate a response to the crisis, encompassing education, work and welfare plans. South Korea has one of the world's lowest fertility rates, a situation Mr. Yoon described as a national emergency. Seoul has poured billions of dollars into schemes to address the problem, as the BBC's Jean McKenzie reports.
The number of children women here are expected to have in their lifetime is now just 0.72. The new ministry would look at how to convince people to have more babies and how to tackle the social fallout in a population that's ageing fast. The president's announcement follows the crushing defeat of his party in last month's parliamentary elections, when he was criticised for being out of touch with the public. Today, he promised to fix the country's problems.
Well, that was Jean McKenzie. Now, experts are warning that the population of 51 million could halve almost by the end of the century. Miranda Choi is a 34-year-old One IT security specialist. My colleague Ed Butler asked her what's stopping her generation from having children.
Well, for me, if I have a good person that I want to spend the rest of my life with, and if I want to establish a family with them, yes, why not? But as of now, I don't really like actively seek out a person to spend my life with or to have a child, so to say. I mean, it's a huge obligation for me.
Has there been a cultural change then in South Korea amongst women that maybe having a family isn't so much of a priority?
I would say that the increasing level of education and the income levels that the Korean woman is experiencing, it gave them an option whether if they want to get married or not. I mean, they could completely support themselves without having to get married. So I guess that kind of influenced the lower birth rates and also decreasing marriage rates as well.
I was going to say, amongst your kind of friends and family, what is mm-hmm. the situation?
Yeah, like a lot of people around me, they don't really have a lot of children. Like, so my mom used to run a kindergarten, and I've seen them over the years, how many children were there and how they were raised. And of course, over the course of time, it has been changing dramatically. Let's say back in the day when my mom started kindergarten, I was the first graduate of my mom's kindergarten. And of course, there were a lot of children. And the way the children was raised was a little different. That means people actually like collaborated with themselves and took care of each other's children. Like a more huge sense of a community, I would say.
Do you think that sense of community, which wrapped round families more than 30 years ago when your mum started her kindergarten, has now gone? And that's, you know, one of the things that might make women think twice about having a child.
I would say yes to that. It's mostly due to the people's exposure to individualism and how, you know, individual opinions more respected, right? And that became like, okay, everyone for themselves, like that kind of thing has started happening. So that, in my opinion, and that's the one of the factors that had caused this societal changes.
The South Korean president wants to bring in a new ministry to address this low birth rate. What could the government do to persuade you? Is there anything that they could do to have children?
Well, of course, governmental policies and subsidies are very important in changing people's mind as well. But I would say that we as a people have to change our mindsets a little bit more towards how much effort and how much resources has to be spent to raise the one child. We always compare ourselves with each other. And especially what I realized about Korean culture is that we care a lot about what other people think of us. And we continuously compare ourselves. It's like a continuous feedback with each other without realizing that that's not a median or that's a little different from what actually is happening in reality.
You're 34 years old now, aren't you? Do you think mm-hmm. about when you're older, and does it worry you that you might not have children to look after you or help you or be company for you in your older age?
Sometimes I think about that, you know, and how our government's policies are always changing and, you know, population of older people are increasing. That means, you know, less young people to support the older people as the time goes. So sometimes I think about that. But another thing that I wanted to think about is that if I want a support system, like a family around me, I think that adoption is always a possible choices that I could make. Because I'm of an age where now I have to think about freezing my eggs, to frankly speaking, but I decided not to because I think that I always have a different choices that I could make, even at the later times.
Miranda Choi there, speaking to my colleague Sam Fennick. Now, the Eurovision Song Contest has transformed itself from a TV show experiment to the world's largest live music event. 160 million people are expected to watch this year's competition in Sweden as 37 countries take part. For songwriters, it's become a very profitable market. Some Eurovision hits have clocked up hundreds of millions of streams. Songwriting camps happen across Europe each year to try and compose a winning song. Daniel Rosny has been speaking to one of the contest's most successful writers.
I'm Linnea Deb. I am a songwriter. So this year I have a song for Malta and a song for Sweden. Oh my God, you got me on. I don't participate in every camp. There's a few that I pick out. It's been a dream since I was six I think. I've been watching Eurovision Song Contest every year, and I'm a big fan of it. I've been writing songs since I was born, I think, but professionally since maybe 2001, 2002, maybe. It's a niche. I found my way of getting my songs out that people actually loved.
Some of these Eurovision songs, the streaming numbers are incredible. As a songwriter, does that then translate into your bank balance?
Well, it depends on what country you're actually competing with, the amount of money, and how much the people in that country actually go to platforms like, let's say, Spotify. But I think I've made most of my money through having a winning song and it being played on the radio. Yeah, of course, that was a big, big thing economically. You know, you have to keep doing it over and over again. You have to write new songs. And I had a breakdown 2017, and I was away maybe for a whole year because I felt that pressure so hard and so much that I had to win Eurovision every year. I had to win for Sweden every year. I had to have the best song, and it was really hard getting over that pressure or the idea of having to be that person. Yeah, it's not easy. I think people are complaining a bit in Sweden about, you know, there's always it's always the same songwriter sitting there and blah blah blah. And well, it's also because we do this full time. We work really really hard trying to get a song.
How long does it take you to start to see the financial benefit of the creative products that you've made?
Yeah, well, that depends on what country you're talking about, but in Sweden it takes a year and a half, so it takes a while. That can be, you know, hard, but that's just the way that we songwriters live. I mean, you hope for success, and if you have it, then it takes a while to get the economy for that. But I mean, if you're in it, then you have the opportunity to actually maybe get another work, you know, another song with another writer or another producer or artist. So it's very important for the songwriters to be part of the whole circus.
Linnea Deb there talking about how you actually produce a winning song, but of course nobody really knows. And if you want to keep up with who's actually got into the final, which is on Saturday, of course, Latvia, Austria, the Netherlands, Norway, Greece, Estonia, Switzerland, Georgia and Armenia, the latest ones to go through, and also Israel. And of course, that very controversial. There's certainly been some demonstrations in Malbo about that by people campaigning, of course, in relation to Gaza, but they have got through. So it could be a very interesting contest on Saturday night. And of course, you can find all about it here on the BBC. That's it from us. Bye-bye.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, 5 mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed, but whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
5 women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in this environment.
Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.